Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour today is scholar, author, philanthropist, and USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences graduate, Dr. Mehdi Haravi. Dr. Haravi was born in Tehran, Iran, and moved to Logan, Utah for high school. He remained in Logan to continue his education. He received bachelor's and master's degrees at Utah State University, received his PhD from the American University School of International Service. Dr. Haravi later served as vice president and provost at the University of Iran. After retirement, he's focused his time on philanthropy, providing support to academic programs and charities, including an orphanage in Iran. He's passionate about encouraging young academic talent. And we'll talk about many scholarships he has and will establish at Utah State University. We'll talk with Dr. Haravi following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour today is scholar, author, philanthropist, and USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences graduate, Dr. Mehdi Haravi. Dr. Haravi was born in Tehran, Iran, and moved to Logan, Utah for high school, remained in Logan to continue his education. He received a bachelor's degree in political science in 1963 and a master's degree in 1964, both at Utah State University. He received his PhD from American University School of International Service. Dr. Haravi later served as vice president and provost at the University of Iran. After retirement, he has focused his time on philanthropy, providing support to academic programs and charities, including an orphanage in Iran. He is passionate about encouraging young academic talent and cares deeply about students receiving access to international programs and other academic opportunities. Today, we're going to review with Dr. Haravi some of the highlights of his very interesting life. Also talk about the Haravi Peace Institute, which he instituted in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, and the Mehdi Haravi Global Teaching and Learning Center in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. That Mehdi Haravi Global Teaching and Learning Center will have its grand opening on Friday. Also talk about scholarships, many scholarships Dr. Haravi has instituted and will institute at the Utah State University. Here's the first part of my conversation with Dr. Haravi. I want to take you back, Dr. Haravi. Grew up in Iran, right? Your father was a pioneering scientist in agriculture.
My father was, a professor of agriculture, and he wrote the first scientific book in agriculture for Iran. And at that particular time, there were quite a few professors from Utah State in Iran, and he knew, if not all of them, most of them. And this is one of the reasons that he sent me to America. And when he told me, "You're going to America, to Utah," I had no idea where Utah was. I was going to school in England, and I was quite happy, but I literally fell in love with America through the American movies of the 50s. Mm. And so I kept on asking my father that, please send me to America, because the impression that I got from those movies that no one works in America. For money, you have to just bend down, pick it up from the ground, or else pick it from the trees. And every American household had 10 cars. Half of them were convertibles. This was the impression the movies of the 50s gave. Mm-hmm. And my father, being French educated, he had European culture, you might say. And he said, no, on one of his visits to England, even at that young age, I was a little suspicious, because whenever I raised America, you know, he said, no, you're going to stay in Europe. He had a smile on his face, and he said, yes, you're right, you're going to America. And as I said, even at that young age, I was a little suspicious. Why all of a sudden a smile, and, you know, very pleasant way of saying you're going to America, you're going to Utah. And at that particular time, I was only familiar with three places in America: New York, because of the tall buildings; Detroit, obviously, because of the huge, huge automobiles of the 50s, and Hollywood, I don't have to specify. And so I arrived in New York. I enjoyed New York very much. And when it was time to come to Utah, this is before the jet age, it took, at least twice, maybe three times as much time to fly from New York to Salt Lake City. As the plane was descending, I was quite certain that the captain was experiencing a mechanical problem. But when he actually landed and said, "Welcome to Salt Lake City," my head, like a windshield wiper, was going right and left. Where's the city? Because in the other cities in the world that I was familiar with, the European cities, Tehran and so forth, when the plane was descending, you could see rivers, trees, houses, cars, you know. You could see life. But over here, I didn't see anything. And the airport was very, very small, and the terminal was even smaller, very small, just like a big room, like the Stevenson Ballroom at the Taggart Center here. And everything was handled by hand. So I picked up my luggage. I was wondering, you know, this is not the America that I had seen in the movies. And so I took a cab to the Greyhound bus station. On the way over, I did see a few shops on the left and on the right, and very few people on the street. I asked the cab driver, is it very far to the heart of the city? He said, you're right in the middle of it. Then I started praying that I hope Logan is bigger than Salt Lake City. But then, as fate turned out, I used to tease my father that you exiled me to Utah, but everything worked out to my benefit. And really, as fate turned out, that was the best thing that happened to me, truly the best thing. I made quite a few friends, and yeah. I still love my friends, and I love them dearly.
So your father, I guess he felt comfortable sending you to America, but to Utah, right? Is that...
He went and consulted his Utah colleagues. Where could I send my son so he wouldn't go astray? They told him, well, Professor Arabi, we have the best place for you, Utah. And so he came to me with a smile and said, you're going to Utah. I have to say, Tom, later on, I think it was in 1960, 61, you know, I could be mistaken, but then two of the professors, Dr. Ross Kelly, who was head of the sociology department, he admitted that he was one of the people who told my father to send your son to Utah so he wouldn't go astray. And another professor, I believe it was Dr. Milligan, he also admitted to me. He said, you know why you're in Utah? I said, my father sent me. He said, yes, with my help.
So you came originally not to university. You came to Logan High School, right?
Because I hadn't finished my high school. Yeah. Yes. I was going to school in England, to my high school, which is called public school, which is private, but then they call it public school. I had 1 year left, and my senior year, I was at Logan High, and I enjoyed it very much, really. Even though I didn't know anyone, but really I made a few friends. As a matter of fact, several of them are from my Logan High days. They're coming for the grand opening of the Mehdi Harabi Global Teaching and Learning Center.
That's great. That's great, yeah. You had some great families that kind of adopted you. There's more than one.
Very much so. That's why I always say, Tom, that I'm qualified to be the Guinness Book of Records for having many fathers and many mothers. One of them was Mr. and Mrs. Sears, the owner of Fred's Flower, Dr. and Mrs. Merrill, that I call him Mr. Utah State himself. A wonderful, wonderful family. And Dr. and Mrs. Boston, that they truly treated me like their own son. As a matter of fact, tonight I'm having dinner with Dan Boston, that jokingly I call him my older brother, who is my younger brother in reality. Yes, he's a retired dentist in town. Yeah.
Then you went to Utah State University. What did, how did you choose a major? What would you decide to go into?
But after my high school graduation, I really could have gone to any other state, to any other university. But even in that short period, I really felt that I have developed roots here. And so I decided, of my own free will and accord, my father didn't have anything to do with it, to enter Utah State. And in a way, from the beginning that I met Dr. Merrill, when I graduated from high school in June of 59, God rest his soul in peace, George Meyer, who was professor of French and international student advisor, used to give a reception for international students at his house, Fourth North, and invited many of the university officials. And even though I was not a graduate of Utah State, but then I was an international student and I was a graduate of Logan High, he invited me. And during that meeting, I was quite impressed with Dr. Merrill. I didn't know him, he didn't know me, but he made a point of coming, shake everyone's hands and just ask them, what are you going to do? And where are you going to go? And so forth. And some of them said, we're going back home and we're going pursue a master's program, or we're going to start teaching those who had received a PhD in various fields. And then when he got to me, I said, well, I'm a graduate of Logan High. I said, well, congratulations. My son is also in Logan High, Steve Merrill. And I recalled his son vividly because he was 2 years younger than us. And I think maybe he had a great deal to do with me majoring in political science, which I'm delighted that I did. He had a great influence on me. He was an intellectual, he was a good professor, but most of all, he was a good, decent human being.
So you had some good mentors, right?
Very much so. Very
sounds
much
like you had a great father and a good upbringing. Was there any culture shock?
No.
Were there any problems adjusting from Iran to Utah?
Not really, because, you know, I was going to school in England for 6 years. So no culture shock.
Yeah.
Well, in some ways, yes, because the expressions that they used in England was quite different here. And I recall my very first night in Logan, I checked in Eccles Hotel, which doesn't exist anymore, and in front of Eccles Hotel was the Dick's Cafe. So I went to Dick's Cafe, and as soon as I walked in, everyone was looking at me very strange, as if though an object has fallen from another planet, because 17 going on 18, I had my tie on and my navy blue jacket on, and with a cufflink that we were supposed to wear to have dinner in England. You might say my high school attire, I had it on. And everyone looked at me, you know, this young fellow, you know, he's very strange. And when I sat behind the counter, when the waitress came to serve me, she didn't serve me. She just looked at me as if though she was going to buy a used car or a horse or something. And then she asked me, where do you come from recently? I said, New York. And then she said, before that, I said, London. I said, before that, Tehran. And she said, oh, I know where Tehran is. I go through it every week to see my uncle in Bountiful. So, but it just happened that I knew where Bountiful was because I just crossed it by Greyhound bus. And then I told her, well, ma'am, let's forget about Bountiful. Let's forget about Tehran. Let's try Middle East. And when I said, I'm from the Middle East, she laughed and said, honey, you're funny. I liked it when she called me honey, but funny, I had no idea why she thinks I'm funny. And then I asked her, why do you think I'm funny? She said, honey, for the second time, I have a brother-in-law who's from the Midwest. I've never heard of the Middle East. So that was, you might say, my initiation to Utah culture. But other than that, everything turned out beautifully.
I think, Dr. Haravi, your goal has been to establish scholarships in, I think it's every department, is it? At least in the College of Humanities?
In every department in College of Humanities, in some of them, more than two, or in some, three. In English, I've established a scholarship in bachelor's, master's, and PhD. Same with sociology. So every department has at least two scholarships in my name. I think there's only one college that one department that they don't offer master's, that they have just one scholarship. Yes.
Big news for Utah Public Radio. You're endowing a scholarship for a Utah Public Radio student.
Not only for Utah Public radio, but it's going to be the biggest scholarship and internship signing agreement in the history of this university. I would be establishing not only for the radio, but for every single college that previously have not established, and one addition to CHAS, because they have a new major, criminology, and one additional to College of Agriculture. Already I've given $500,000 to College of Agriculture because they have a new department. So every single college now have received one scholarship from me. CHAS, Education, and Agriculture have received much, much more. Obviously, CHAS leads.
Well, thank you so much on behalf of UPR, behalf of the whole university, the college. It continues to be very important to you to support students. Where does this come from?
Well, basically, I feel there are two types of obligation. One obligation is mandatory, like showing up for work, paying taxes, obeying the laws and regulations of the country. Another obligation is a type of an obligation that brings you joy, brings you happiness, brings you satisfaction, and that's obligation of love. And that is my obligation towards Utah State. Since I've gone to school here, since I've received much from this university, I really feel a moral obligation of love to help the students who are in need. And when I receive letters from some of the students, when they express that without this scholarship, it would have been impossible for them to go to college, that is my satisfaction. Mm. That is my happiness and joy.
You're listening to Access Utah. We're talking today with scholar, author, philanthropist, USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences graduate, Dr. Mehdi Haravi, reviewing some highlights from his very interesting life, talking about his philanthropy. You heard just there. Many scholarships, including a scholarship for Utah Public Radio. We're very grateful for that. Many of those scholarships are going to be announced today. And exciting news, the Mehdi Haravi Global Teaching and Learning Center in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University will receive its grand opening on Friday. And so that is happening Friday, 2 p.m., the Southwest Quad on the Logan campus. That's open to the public. I hope you come and support that. We'll have much more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour today is scholar, author, philanthropist, and USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences graduate, Dr. Mehdi Haravi. Dr. Haravi was born in Tehran, Iran, moved to Logan, Utah for high school, remained in Logan for his bachelor's and master's degrees at Utah State University. Received his PhD from American University School of International Service. He later served as vice president and provost at the University of Iran. And after retirement, he's focused his time on philanthropy. And that's included many scholarships at Utah State University, including a scholarship just announced this week for Utah Public Radio. Our thanks to Dr. Haravi for that. Many other scholarships are being announced this week as well. And big news, the Mehdi Haravi Global Teaching and Learning Center at Utah State University will receive its grand opening. Everyone's invited to that. That is Friday, 2 p.m., Southwest Quad on the Logan USU campus. Here's part two of my recent conversation with Dr. Haravi. It sounds like you got on well at Utah State University. One thing, you were the first international student in the university's history to become a campus-wide independent senator.
Very much so. And believe me, that was not very easy. I mean, not easy, but as soon as I filed application, I felt very sorry that, I'm going to get three or four votes and then I have to transfer to another university because it's going to be a disgrace. Everyone would tease me, a landslide senator. But then I think that changed my attitude, really. I was in love with Utah, but then that really added to my deep love for the this university and for the Utah culture. Yes, I was elected, and I did defeat the other people. And so that was a big, yes, big, very big moment for me.
So you got bachelor's and master's at yes. Utah State. Then you went to American University School of International Service to get your PhD. What was your plan? Your area of political science, I guess?
International relations.
International relations yes. is what you wanted to do. And your first position, Tennessee Technological University.
At that time, it was at the height of the Vietnam War, and all the money was going to war efforts. And universities were not hiring. Many PhDs in various fields were already working as waiters, as dishwashers, and so forth. I think because of my background, you know, coming from Iran, England, U.S., and Middle East, you know, I think that helped me to receive five offers, I believe. And Tennessee was one of them. And when I went and talked to my professors at American University, all of them unanimously said that you don't want to go to Tennessee. So I'd never been to Tennessee before, and I said, well, maybe they know something that I don't know. But then one afternoon I was lying in my small efficiency apartment in Washington, and I had a phone call from Dr. Richard Fraser, head of Department of History and Political Science at Tennessee Technological University. He invited me down, no strings attached, to meet the university and just visit them with no strings attached. So I did go. And they were very kind. And the salary they offered me was more than the so-called northern universities, and the teaching load was less. And they said that we would put this in writing. In those days, it was special delivery, not express mail. So I received a letter by a special delivery. I took the letter and showed it to those professors who said, you don't want to go to Tennessee. When they read the letter, said, take the job. They want you badly. And again, Tennessee was like Utah, fate. I enjoyed every second of it. I made quite a few friends. And whenever they felt that maybe I'm flirting with another university or with another institution, they immediately did something. I didn't say anything to them, but then they felt it. They immediately did something to keep me. And again, that was another good choice. Fate.
You eventually went back to Iran, University of Iran, served as vice president and provost. So years in England and America. How was that going back to Iran?
I was offered the job of vice presidency of a university. This is before the revolution, obviously. And I thought this is a very good promotion. And I took it, and it was very good. And I was promoted to provost. And everything was working out until the revolution happened. That naturally, they purged not only me, many other people of our positions. And everything changed.
Now, in retirement, you've turned to philanthropy. Utah State University is a grateful recipient of much of that. One of your mottos is humanity is a priority, and no one should and one should always strive to make the world a better place. Where does that come from?
I think during the period that the only thing that you have is time for reflection and to plan your future. And I think that period, in a way, helped me a great deal to never take anything for granted, because here I was a provost, but now I'm no longer. And so never take anything for granted and try to have a legacy that would be an honorable one. When you pass on, if you have a huge bank account, that is not really a legacy. But when you pass on, I think your legacy is what you have contributed to other people. And that would remain, and hopefully eternally. See, when you think good and positive, you emancipate yourself from fear and negativism.
So that's a huge change, obviously. The revolution comes, you're a provost of the university, now no longer, and I guess wondering what the future's going to hold. How do you handle that kind of a huge change in your life?
If you have determination, I think you handle it very well. But if you keep on feeling sorry for yourself and crying for yourself, you would never achieve anything. People should have determination. People should have hope. And you should think positive.
Yeah.
Really. And know that low aim in life is a crime.
Mm. Yeah. I've heard you say that before. Low aim is a crime. What?
I always say this.
Yes.
You're the only one who remembers it.
I definitely remember it. I think it's a great motto. Tell me why that's one of your mottos.
Because if you don't aim high, you're not going to go high. Now, by aiming high, you're not going to be successful each time. But if you fall down, it's not a shame. But if you remain fallen, it's a tragedy. And so aim high, and if you don't succeed the first time, try it again.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you will.
Yeah. What's your advice to students? They're going to have ups and downs. Obviously, you want them to aim high. What's your advice to them?
I always tell them that. First and foremost, believe in yourself. But believe in yourself realistically. If you're 5'6", don't think that you are 7'5". Believe in yourself realistically. Believe your assets. Believe the things that you can't do. Work hard. Be positive. And be agreeable. Think good. Think forward. And train your mind to see other people, the good in other people, the positive in other people. So then you would be a free person. You would be free of negativism. You would be free of fear. And I think they would be successful. Or jokingly, if someone is in a hurry to get ahead, as soon as you graduate from college, marry the boss's daughter or the boss's son.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't get you very much.
Right. I want to talk about the Harari Peace Institute. You've instituted this. This is important to you.
Very much
peace
so.
Initiatives. What do you hope the Peace Institute can accomplish?
I hope everyone that goes through the Peace Institute and the Global Teaching Learning Center become a promoter of peace, a defender of human dignity. And they should know that peace doesn't come to us automatically. We have to cultivate peace. We have to work. We have to understand the other person's point of view, his culture, his language. This is why I said the other building would enter. And with dialogue, with no fear, with positive attitude, yes, it's a very long journey, but let's not forget, a journey of 1,000 miles also begins with the first step.
Mm.
So this is a first step.
Tell me about the Medihiravi Global Teaching and Learning Center. This is the grand opening is on Friday. This is a big project that you've spearheaded. This will house USU's languages and cultures.
Well, I did not alone spearhead that. Many people worked hard on it. This Global Teaching and Learning Center, to many people's surprise, has gone through 3 Utah State administrations, starting with a dear friend of mine, Stan Ulbrich, and the Board of Trustees at that time that they voted unanimously to be named after me. Then it moved on to another friend, Noel Cockard, and now the ribbon cutting of the grand opening is with another friend, Betsy Cantwell. So it has a journey of 3 administrations and 2 deans, 2 good friends, John Allen and Joe Ward. And this building is a building of opportunity for our students to become familiar with other cultures, learn other languages. And this could, again, like the journey of 1,000 miles, be the first step to international understanding. Mm. And hopefully by that, we would have less conflict and more peace. And I think this is a big step, and I have faith in our students, I have faith in our faculty members, and I'm humbled, honored, and proud, and grateful to Utah State Legislature, to 2 Board of Trustees, the previous one and the present one, and to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to O.C. Tanner Foundation, to Radcliffe family, to Alder and Cannon family, to Smoot family, to Harmon and Julia R., Feldman family, C.C. Harrison Foxley, Doc Foxley. If I have missed someone, you should have told me that you're going to ask me this question, so I would have come with it.
Right.
So if I've missed someone, it's your fault, Tom, yeah. Not mine.
Okay, duly noted. I wish I had the list in front of me as well, but I think they'll understand, and they'll be acknowledged at the ceremony, I'm sure. Dr. Ravi, anything else you'd like to say at this point?
I hope that the Utah Public Radio is doing a wonderful job, but I hope you would be internationally listened to.
I hope that as well, yes. And thank you again so much.
My pleasure.
The Medihiravi Student Scholarship, Utah Public Radio, that'll help so much.
You see, I told you the last time I was here was several years ago.
So yes.
I told you that, you know, I would be back to you, so I'm old-fashioned. When I make a promise, I keep a promise.
You kept your word, and thank you so much on behalf of Utah Public Radio.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. You just heard there, talked with Dr. Medihiravi, recorded that conversation earlier this week. Dr. Hiravi is in Logan for several events. One of those is happening today, where he's signing some scholarship endowments for various departments and colleges at Utah State University, including, as you heard there, the Medihiravi Student Scholarship for Utah Public Radio. We're very grateful for that. And a big event on Friday, the Medihiravi Global Teaching and Learning Center in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University is receiving its grand opening. That'll be happening on Friday, 2 p.m., Southwest Quad on the Logan USU campus. Be unveiling that new center, and everyone is invited to that event. Our thanks to Dr. Hiravi for this conversation. Thanks to you for listening. Following a break, We're going to fill out this hour with a couple of our popular segments. We'll hear Eating the Past and Wild About Utah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
This is Wild About Utah.
The most important lessons I can give my daughter are not through me, but instead those found best in the wild. Though she can't talk, I know she still listens. Though her childhood amnesia is inevitable, I know that neural circuits are still being formed. Those circuits will do her good one day. Our favorite lesson is in the tenacity of beavers. This winter, we took one of our favorite hikes through knee-deep post-holing snow to one of our favorite beaver dams. The dogs trot ahead, sniff snuffing at the path, darting to the stream that runs alongside our trail and back, and lead us, as they have many times before, up the trail. When we come to the Great Beaver Dam, the one that assuredly took not just years but generations of beavers to build, we stop for a snack and water and let our daughter sit quizzically in the springtime slush. I explain to her the parts of the beaver's home, the dam, the lodge, how they store their food. She listens while she smushes snow in her mittens, neural circuits are formed, and we pack up to start the slushy walk back to the car. A good day's hike and lesson. A Greek proverb is dusted off in my mind, that a society grows great when old men plant trees under whose shade they know they shall never sit. Those beavers are good Greeks, but likely poor hoplites. Later that spring, we return to the dam, our trails shortened by melted snow. Snow is gone from the trail, but still holding fast in the mountains above. The travel is easier, muddier, but the beaver platonic republic justly endures. I explain the parts of the Castorian city-state yet again, and explain what the beavers are doing now that we see fresh aspen fells. They're collecting good sugars and preparing for their kits. Callipolis endures, as it has, another year out of dozens of millennia, and even without a cud of pulp in sight. I wonder if beavers have oral traditions. Time then passes as we all pass through space, and summer buds, blooms, and begins to fade. The cattle have come, grazed, trammeled, and been driven off yet again. We return to Xanadu in the early morning before the sun beats hard. We can even get closer to the dam now that the forest gates are open, and we prepare for our adventure. My daughter looks around excitedly and drinks water from her cup. The dogs look around excitedly at all the leftover cow pies to investigate. Luckily, they've dried. We exit the car and make our short way to the beavers, only to discover that tragedy has struck between spring and now. The dam has burst. Like the River Isen, a great work of nature has blown a hole in the waterkeep and drained the promised pond. The shoreline has receded like a tonsure, the lodge's secret doors exposed as if by moonlit Ithilden, and the water flowing with Newtonian determination towards Great Salt Lake. It's shocking at first, seeing this anchor of time heaved asunder, the work of generations of beavers up and smote by springtime runoff. All that labor, all those lives well lived, perhaps not wasted, but at least now remembered with a sigh. I sigh out as well and explain this all to my daughter. She listens, pulls on cow mown grasses, synapses fire, and circuits connect. We complete our hike and eventually go home. Finally, early this fall, we set off for the utopia that was once more. Colors have begun to change to golds and crimsons. The air is more crisp, the heat more bearable. We saddle up in the toddler backpack and see what there is to see of the beavers. We arrive to wonders of hope and joy, and the tenacity of those beavers. The dam, it appears, is not abandoned. The labor of generations is honored with the restoration of the work. Not in its entirety, mind you, for that will again take years and perhaps generations, but the work is underway regardless. Greek thinking again prevails. Whether by purpose or itch, it matters not, but slowly the pond is regrowing. The shoreline has risen to swallow back and douse bare earth, and the water's a bit more wine dark. I excitedly show my daughter, who is excitedly playing with my hat, the work that has happened, and the work yet to do. The beavers will not quit when allowed to do so. They are tenacious little buggers whose teeth grow forever. We take it all in and continue our hike, and eventually circle back and go home. A new proverb pops into my head. A society grows great when we get to work and, figuratively, give a damn. I'm Patrick Kelly, and I'm Wild About Utah.
Welcome to Utah Public Radio's Eating the Past and Other Tasty Morsels, a show that explores all things food.
Your hosts are Jeannie Sir Jamie Sanders, Laura Gelfand, and Tammy Proctor, all from Utah State University.
This is Tammy Proctor. Welcome to Eating the Past. My guest today is our guest from last week, Ella Hawkins, who is a theater historian. She works on costumes and design, and she's a historic biscuit maker. And so listen to last week if you want to know more about that. But today we wanted to talk a little bit about icing or frosting or whatever you call it. I think that it's one of the big differences between Great Britain and the United States. That along with some of the words we use, obviously. But, I mean, my mom used to use Crisco and powdered sugar and make a very fluffy icing. Sometimes holiday cookies have a harder icing, but really, cakes, cookies in the United States often have very sweet, very squishy kinds of icings. I mean, who doesn't love buttercream?
Oh, for
right?
sure. Yeah.
Right. So, but in Britain, I've encountered much different kind of frostings for cakes and cookies. And so I'd like to ask Ella to talk a little bit about icing in Britain and also how royal icing works for decorating. This is a icing I've only discovered in the last few years that I love making. So I'll turn it over to the expert.
Great. Yeah, we have a lot of buttercream as well.
Yes.
Buttercream is very common in the UK. In fact, it's the crucial filling in the Victoria sponge, which might be the most British of all cakes.
True.
Where you have your like yellow sponge and it's got jam, jelly, you would call it,
right, yeah.
with buttercream in there as well. We have royal icing, which has been a very traditional cake icing for a long time, for centuries. And that might go on a wedding cake, on a Christmas cake. There would be a layer of marzipan underneath, probably. You have marzipan here, right?
We do, but we don't use it as much, I think, as you do in British desserts.
Yeah, yeah. Also, ganache is very popular with us.
Yes.
So if you're very much a chocolate enjoyer, as I am, my birthday cake often has chocolate ganache to have extreme chocolate elements to my frosting.
Yes, we actually have a wonderful patisserie bakery just over the border in Malad that's called Ganache.
Ah.
And they make beautiful cakes.
Oh, I must go. In terms of royal icing as a medium, it's something that I keep discovering new things about it, of how fantastic it is for creating these edible representations of historic books or artifacts. And I think what's so good about it is, first of all, that you can layer it. So you can have a base layer that might have a design that you've created while the icing is wet. For example, if you have one solid color, you can drop different colors into it to create patterns. That will then set absolutely solid, and you can build up a second layer on top of that. And I've done that to create William Morris inspired designs, for example. But also, even more interestingly, you can age it. So if I'm making a biscuit or cookie version of an ancient Greek pottery shard, I can scratch it. I can dab all these different colours onto it, sort of shading with powders to make it look like it's been, I don't know, in the earth for 1,000 years. It really takes that and it starts to look like the original thing. And I think that's something that, because it's got that solid quality to it, you can really manipulate it, as well as painting onto it. So you've got different options. You can paint it gold, you can make it look like metal, you can make it look like fabric.
That's so awesome.
It's so awesome. Yeah, so royal icing is my favorite kind of frosting or icing.
It's also extremely easy to make.
Yeah.
And I mean, it basically has three ingredients. Mm-hmm. Meringue powder that typically you use.
We call it egg white powder.
Yep. And powdered sugar.
Yeah.
And water.
Yeah. And maybe a bit of flavoring if you
and
want to add
flavoring,
some vanilla.
Yep. Yeah. That's and then I think you use either vodka or lemon juice to set it, right? To set
I
the colors.
It. I use it as a, if you were doing watercolor painting, you'd use water to transfer the solid paint onto your paper. And vodka, that's what it does for me. It's like a transfer medium. It thins the edible ink and it then evaporates completely. So it doesn't remain on the surface, but it's a painting medium, I suppose.
Oh, it's so fascinating. So if you want to see examples of what these look like, please go to the Eating the Past website, where we will link to Ella's own website, where she has some of these creations on display. She also tells you the ingredients, which I think is really cool. You can see the flavors, and then you can try it at home. So join us next week for Eating the Past, just before the splendid table at noon on Utah Public Radio.